see some motivation from that. So I think you all know that the discovery, 1998, people discovered that the universe accelerates. Not only the expansion of the universe, not only the universe expands, but it accelerates, and this is something that has been well established since that time. The discovery was made with type 1A supernova. There has been other evidence for the acceleration of the universe, cosmological background experiments, experiments with clusters of galaxies, and so on. So if you take seriously this data, and if you think the general relativity is correct, something like 71% of the energy content of the universe is not luminous dark matter and is not dark matter. So you get this big chunk of the energy content of the universe to explain. So of course, the first thing that people thought were the cosmological constant, and then they came talking about other models. So there are many, many models. Now the implications are not only for cosmology, but of course also for fundamental physics. So there are several popular explanations or classes of models for the acceleration of the universe. So the simplest explanation, and the one that is probably more appealing, most appealing to astronomers, is a cosmological constant. So if you take a cosmological constant in general relativity, and you give it the right value, that explains all the data, that fits all the data beautifully. But the cosmological constant comes with some problems. So why the cosmological constant is so small? Now you got a double problem, because before knowing about the acceleration of the universe, you know that if you do some simple back of the envelope quantum mechanics calculation, you get a huge value for the density of the cosmological constant, 120 orders of magnitude larger than what you should get. So at that point,
so seeing this are back of the envelope calculation, maybe you could show them.
Well,
not all of us have a background, but if they're simple, right? So back of the envelope.
No, there is. It's basically, okay, at least the theorists would consider back of the envelope calculation. So this energy density is basically get the integrator in the 3k, k square plus m square, and you integrate this, you would integrate this between 0 and plus infinity. Then things diverge, so you have to put a cutoff here, inside you put a cutoff k zero at the Planck scale. So at that point, forget the masses, you get here a part from a factor of pi, you get a decay k square, another k here, so it's a k cube, right? Neglect the masses because we're talking about like energies. So you get something like k to the fourth. So this would diverge like
okay.
k to the fourth.
What is this again?
It is the energy density of quantum vacuum.
Okay.
So you're saying that my vacuum is an ensemble of oscillators, so each one has the Hamiltonian of the oscillator. So you're looking at the dominant terms, here is the momentum, right?
Okay. Uh-huh.
So you integrate this between zero and cutoff, say, it could be the Planck scale. So you get here something that diverges like k to the fourth. When you get a cutoff, you get k Planck to the fourth. And this is what gives you the energy density about 10 to the 120 times what you observe now.
So you do it here, this place would be both on the left and right hand side of the process, right? So you
Now, how do you get away from this? Well, you can think if you believe in supergravity, this cutoff is not K Planck, but it's the scale of supergravity. Then you get bosons and Fermi contributions that cancel out. But still, you get a cutoff here, which is the supergravity scale, which is 10 to the 40 times what you should see. So there is something wrong there. So that's the back of the envelope. That's why I'm saying back of the envelope. You can make it more complicated, but that's basically what it is. The problem is a bit more dramatic because I'm using the energy density, so it's a mass scale to the fourth. So okay, I'm making it a little bit more dramatic, which if you think of a mass scale, it's not so bad, but it's still very bad. Okay, so this is what Weinberg called the most important problem of theoretical physics. It is an embarrassment, okay? So the idea was, well, somehow we don't know how the cosmological constant is zero, or it doesn't gravitate, it gives you zero energy density, and someday we will solve that problem, and that's all there is. Now, in 1998, the astronomers come and tell you, well, actually, if there is a cosmological constant, first you must put it to zero, and then you must resurrect a little bit of that value and fine-tune things to 120 orders of magnitude. This is really bad, so people would like to think, most theorists think, well, okay, lambda gives you zero, the energy density of lambda is zero, and we will solve that problem some other time, and there is something else that explains the acceleration of the universe. Of course, astronomers don't like to think about about this, they say lambda is some number that I put phenomenological into the Einstein equations, and if I give it the right value, it's a constant of nature that I measure, I get to explain the acceleration of the universe, but that's not what theoretical physicists like. So let's say that most people like to get away from the cosmological constant, and there is something else that explains the acceleration of the universe. So they invented dark energy. So what is this dark energy? Well, we are used to do cosmology with a perfect fluid. So this fluid would be something that is very exotic. They must have an equation of state in which the pressure is approximately equal to minus the energy density. So negative pressure and extremely negative, very, very strange thing. So it mimics the cosmological constant and the equation of state of the cosmological constant. So this dark energy doesn't dominate early the dynamics of the universe early on. It must come to dominate later, because otherwise you cannot form galaxies, because the universe expands and accelerates. You will never form galaxies. We wouldn't be talking about that here. We wouldn't be here. So this must come to dominate the dynamics of the universe later. So first you have a radiation era, you get Big Bang nucleosynthesis, then you get a matter-dominated era in which you form galaxies, and only later on you start accelerating the universe. This dark energy can be many, many things. Everybody comes up with its own favorite model of dark energy. If you have a pet theory, you can probably try to mimic the acceleration of the universe with that. And things got very crazy. For example, this dark energy could be even phantom energy, which has an equation of state P less than minus rho. That one has some really radical consequences. For example, it causes a singularity in the future of the universe, a big grip singularity in which the universe explodes at a finite time. So you get a singularity at a finite time. Of course, this is something silly, but it's still not ruled out by the observation. From time to time, people say that this is actually the favored state of the universe according to observations. Okay, so dark energy anyway is something that we have invented just to explain the observation. So if you try to fit the universe, what you observe in the universe into general relativity, you have to come up either with a cosmological constant or with dark energy. Just to give you some context, there are other ideas on the table. So people have come up with the back reaction of inhomogeneities. So when you do general relativity, the equations are nonlinear. And when you take an average, you get some local inhomogeneities, and those back react on the dynamics of the universe. This is something that has been around for many years. So taking the average, and taking the average doesn't commute with Einstein equation, essentially, because of nonlinearity. So for sure, there is some kind of effect of local inhomogeneities on the background of the dynamics of the universe. This is something that is very hard to compute. And there has been a claim that actually this back reaction could accelerate the universe. Except it has never been shown. So there are many assumptions that go into computing this back reaction, and it has never been shown that the magnitude is the magnitude that is sufficient to accelerate the universe, and it has never been shown that the sign of the acceleration is the right one. In fact, there is a fairly recent work by Green and Wald in which they show that under certain technical assumptions, when you do this kind of averaging and you use a rigorous formalism to compute the inhomogeneities, you get a universe that decelerates. So that idea, I think, is pretty much out of the window now. Another idea was that perhaps we live at the center of some giant void, and what we see is actually that because we live in a local underdensity, we see that the universe accelerates faster around us. This one is another idea that in principle is viable, but to make it fit the observations of the cosmic microwave background, you need to abandon the Copernican principle. So essentially, you need to be inside the giant void, which is about the size of the observable universe, something like that, and you need to be very close to the center and almost at rest. So also that one is not, it has a lot of conceptual fine-tuning. So I think either you stick with dark energy or you modify gravity, which is another idea, and that's what I want to talk about. So, yes?
None of those things actually solve the cosmological constant problem.
None of these solves the cosmological constant problem, even modified gravity. So the cosmological constant problem is there, and maybe we will solve it someday. None of these deals with the cosmological constant problem. So it's there. So there are several kinds of modifying gravity that you can come up with. You can come up with brain wall models and several different models. One model that has been very popular is the so-called FFR gravity, modified FFR gravity. So how does it work? If you think of the Einstein-Hilbert action of general relativity, the action of gravity would be something like this, k here is 8 pi g. I'm using units in which c equal 1. And in the Einstein Hilbert gravity, you get the Ricci scalar here, plus possibly a cosmological constant if you want to put it in. And modified f over gravity changes the action, so you make this r into a nonlinear function of r. And matter is just the usual matter. So the idea of modified gravity is getting away from dark energy, getting away from all these other ideas that seem extremely fine-tuned or kind of silly in some sense. So you explain the acceleration of the universe just by modifying gravity. Now, if you try to modify gravity, this is something that is kind of dangerous. Now, if you think about the metric tensor that describes your space-time, in principle, the metric tensor contains several degrees of freedom. You can get tensor degrees of freedom, vector degrees of freedom, scalars, and this can be massless or massive. In general relativity, you have only a massless spin-to-graviton that propagates, so that's all the degrees of freedom that you have. But when you modify the Einstein-Hilbert action, these other degrees of freedom that are buried in the metric tensor propagate, so you get scalar modes and vector modes that appear. So for the Einstein-Hilbert action, if you change, for the Einstein-Hilbert action, you get only this spin 2 field. But if you go to a nonlinear function of the Ricci scalar in the action, you get the usual massless spin 2 graviton plus a scalar field, which is massive, and this can drive the cosmic acceleration. So if you think about early universe inflation, most of the models of the early universe are in general relativity with a scalar field, massive with a potential, and that's what drives the expansion, accelerated expansion in the early universe inflation. So here the idea is the same. Once you promote this action to a nonlinear function, you get this massive scalar field, which can actually drive the acceleration of the universe. People that have been trying to quantize gravity since the 60s and the 70s can come up with other quadratic, other nonlinear terms in the curvature. So you can have Ricci square, Riemann square, Weyl square terms. So this, there could be other terms that you can include in the action if you want to. Well, in this case, you get massive gravitons and other vector degrees of freedom that propagate. I'm not going to do that here. I'm just taking the simplest model. So there are a couple of reviews here from 2010 on this field, and I count about 1,500 articles in the last decade on these theories. Now, this is nothing compared to graphene. There you count about 20,000 articles, but still, this tells you that people have taken rather seriously this kind of modifications of gravity. Probably the field is overinflated because there has been way, way too much of this work without actually focusing on one part, what are the physical characteristics. There are a lot of these papers that focus on particular models. None of these is actually justified from the theoretical point of view. So what I'm going to do here, I'm going to talk about the general features of this class of theories, not about particular models. But okay, my point of view here is that this f of r gravity is just a toy model to see, can we explain the acceleration of the universe by modifying gravity in principle without throwing in too many complicated things? Turns out you can, with some fine-tuning, like for all these dark energy models or other models. And I wouldn't go to take this class of models more seriously. A lot of people think that they have even the theory of f of r that is right, or that this is the right way to do it. To me, it's just a toy model. So it shows that in principle you can do it, but I can't make any particular claims. Okay, well, now you're trying to modify gravity, so things can be ugly if you modify gravity. There are some risks. First of all, there could be deviation from general relativity and Newtonian gravity, even on terrestrial scales and solar system scales. So there are experiments on solar system scales, and you don't want to violate these experiments. From the theoretical point of view, the theory could be completely unstable, so your space-time could disappear, evaporate in a moment. There could be ghosts, there could be superluminal propagation, so you want to stay away from these kind of things. And you're doing science, so you want to predict something. So the way to predict something in this theory of gravity or in any mechanics problem is that you must have an initial value problem, so if you give me initial conditions and the forces that are acting on my particles, I must be able to predict something. So if the initial value problem is not well posed, you could have a loss of predictability. So we should worry about that too. When you go and look at the history of f of r gravity, there has been a long history going back to 1919 with Weyl, Eddington. Eddington verified Einstein's theory with the eclipse, solar eclipse in 1919. 3 years later, he was already playing on how to modify gravity. Of course, in those days, there was no motivation other than curiosity, try to see how things can be different. In the 60s, things changed because when people tried to quantize gravity, the first attempt, they realized that gravity, general relativity, is not normalizable, but you have to add some counter terms to renormalize gravity. So Utyam and DeWitt in the 60s and still in the 70s showed that you would have to add some terms that are quadratic in the Ricci tensor if you want to have a hope of renormalizing. The first model of inflation in the early universe was not actually made with scalar fields. It was the Sarobinsky model in 1980, and that one used a correction like this to the Einstein-Hilbert action. So if you include a quadratic term like that, you can actually get inflation. This worked, and now everybody is trying to do inflation in many ways, but mostly with scalar fields. Okay, the kind of modifications of gravity that I'm going to show you for explaining the current acceleration of the universe now actually don't have terms like these. They have different terms. And it is claimed that there are some motivations from string theory for non-quadratic corrections. Of course, if you invoke string theory, they can justify pretty much anything in this contrary. But there is also some other field of quantum gravity in which asymptotic safety, in which you try to find ultraviolet fixed points of gravity. And the idea is that gravity is non-perturbable, severely normalizable. Things seem to work, and most recently, in the last 2 or 3 years, people find F of R theories coming out of that. So there are some motivation for F of R theories in general. So
when usually asymptotic safety work at the very high end, the high end is sort of whatever, if you can expand in R, this correction in R will come.
Yeah, I'm not making a strong case of this, and also string theory would think that, this would be introducing corrections that are Planck scale suppressed, right? But you could have other terms, and there has been work in which you get also low energy corrections. And for example, when you have derivative couplings, you can get terms that manifest themselves at large scale. Cliff Burgess has worked on that too, and he had some corrections at low energy. So it's not necessarily that if you put high energy corrections, these are suppressed, Planck scale suppressed. So you could get some large scale effects too. So the prototype, originally,
So if I have this F of R in the metric, right? So how does the Newton law is modified?
You must recover Newton law exactly, otherwise you throw out the theory. So within the experimental test, you must get the Newtonian gravity, and also you must satisfy the post-Newtonian limits. So the fact here is you get deviations. So the idea is you get deviations from Newtonian gravity or general relativity at large scales. So the idea is that you get something that locally behaves like Newtonian gravity or general relativity, but on very large scales, you could be seeing deviations from general relativity. The idea is not too bad because...
compared to the Newtonian force, for example, is it becoming stronger or weaker?
Depends really on what your F of R is, but that one is controlled and you don't change it. So the idea is that general relativity is tested very poorly at scales larger than the solar system. So when we see the acceleration of the universe, we could actually be seeing the first deviation from general relativity. But it's only something that shows up on large scales. It's going to be extremely hard to detect these on local scales. People have been thinking about that too, but you're talking about many, many orders of magnitude. So just to give an idea, the first models that appear in the literature was F of R is R minus an inverse power of R, where mu here is a mass scale, which is something like the Hubble parameter, so 10 to the minus 33 electron volts. The idea is when the universe expands and the curvature becomes smaller and smaller, this term here kicks in and it starts to dominate, so late in the history of the universe. Early on, when R is large, this term here is irrelevant and you get dense and Hilbert action, or possibly could get inflationary corrections. So this was put forward by Capozzello in 2003 and his collaborators and Carol, Duvuri, Troden, and Turner about a month later. So this was the idea. This particular model is ruled out now because one, it violates the Wakefield limits, and second, it's subject to various instabilities, fatal instability. There are many models of F of R in the literature, many more than these, in fact. So I'm not going to be tied to any particular model. I will try to tell you something in general about this theory. There are three versions of F of R gravity, and I'm going to focus mostly on the metric formalism. The metric formalism is the one that we are used to with general relativity. So you take the metric as your variables, and you vary the action with respect to the metric. You get some field equations, which I'm going to show in a moment. They're fourth order. you can get another variation, the so-called Palatini variation, in which you take the metric and the connection of space-time, the way that the object that gives you the rule to compute the covariant derivatives, and you vary these independently. For general relativity, you get exactly the same result, exactly the same equations. When your action is non-linear in the Ricci scalar, you get different results. So in this case here, you get second-order field equation. In this other case here, you get fourth-order field equations. And there is a third version, which was pioneered by Tommaso Tiro and Stefano Liberati, in which not only you allow the metric part of the connection to couple to the metric, but also to the connection. And this in general, here, you fit naturally some torsion into the space-time. That brings you to some other issues. For example, when you have torsion in space-time, you tend to couple that to the spin of particles. And that's something that was studied a lot in the 70s. Things become a little bit more ill-defined because at some point, in my opinion, you go back to some ideas from particle physics and you don't know exactly what you want to do with the cosmology here. So this is something that largely is still unexplored. I will focus mostly on the first, essentially only on the first formalism. So the action is this one. You vary the action with respect to the inverse metric tensor and you get field equations that look like this. To compare with general relativity, in general relativity you would get Rb minus 1 half jbr equal to 8 pi g times the stress energy tensor of matter. So that's what you get if you put f of r equal r. Now, the left hand side is not a dramatic change, but the right hand side here has fourth order terms because the Ricci scalar is some horrible nonlinear combination of the metric, its first derivative, second derivative. So you got second order derivatives here, the metric here in r, and then you get another two derivatives, so you get fourth order terms. That changes the game quite a bit. One thing that you learn from the field equations is that if you take the trace of this, you get an equation for this quantity f prime of r. So this is a D'Alembertian in curve space. So this is telling you there is a wave equation for this degree of freedom f prime of r. So this f prime of r is the degree of freedom that propagates. So that's your scalar field, massive scalar field of the theory, which is something in addition to the usual massless spin to graviton. By contrast, if you take general relativity and you take the trace of the Einstein equations, you get an algebraic equation and nothing propagates there. So here you get a new degree of freedom and that's how you see that it propagates. And what else can you say in general? This theory here, I'll show you in a moment, it's equivalent to a scalar tensor theory. So it requires the graviton carries positive energy. So this function f prime of r must be positive in order to guarantee a positive effective gravitational coupling. This is something that is normally. So you can rewrite your field equations in a way that they look like formal Einstein equations. So they would look like this. G is equal to k over f prime r. That's why I'm saying that the effective gravitational coupling is, the effective gravitational coupling is g over f prime of r, so that's why I impose that f prime is positive. And this way, when you try to rewrite the equation with effective Einstein equations, you say that you have the usual matter here with this modified gravitational coupling, plus all the other terms that come from this geometry, and you dump them into an effective stress energy tensor. So you say I have some effective form of matter, and this one doesn't have to satisfy any of the reasonable energy conditions that ordinary matter satisfies in relativity, because it's all made of geometric terms. You can't impose anything in that. So you can have potentially some effective negative energies and strange things like that. So if you assume that you want to do cosmology, this is the metric of the universe that we see. There is a scale factor that describes how the space expands. These are your field equations. So these are the usual equations for the Hubble parameter of cosmology. And you have added to the regular matter these other terms here, which come from the f of r. You can change the dynamics quite a bit in this way. Turns out that this class of theories of f of r gravity is completely equivalent to a subclass of a theory of scalar tensor gravity that has been around since the 60s, essentially. So this f of r gravity that was resurrected is just scalar tensor gravity. In fact, it's Bransky theory with some potential. And Bransky theory has been known since the 60s, 1961. So at the beginning, when people were starting working on f of r gravity, somebody was saying, well, we know everything about these theories. Why do you bother spending time on that? Well, answer is we don't really know this. We don't really understand this because a lot of new things came out that we didn't know before. So turns out that if you assume that the second derivative of this function f of r is non-zero, metric f of r is equivalent to Bransky theory with a special parameter that appears in the theory, which is zero, and with some potential for this effective scalar field. And the Palatini version is equivalent to a pathological scalar tensor theory, but I won't talk about that. And this is something that goes back to 1969, actually Peter Higgs had a paper in which he showed for some particular case the equivalence between this higher order gravity and scalar tensor gravity. So how does it work? This is your action, and assume that f second is different from zero. Introduce a new action in which I will call chi, the Ricci scalar, and this is another action that I claim to be equivalent to the previous one. So if you put chi equal r, then this one reduces trivially to that other one, and there is nothing really to think about. Instead, suppose, okay, oh yeah, sorry, I didn't show you this. This f of chi here, this quantity here, so chi is equal to r, and this f of chi is just f prime of r, essentially. And this is the effective potential that comes out. This effective potential is defined in some implicit way as a function of r. So the theory is complicated in the sense that the potential is not defined explicitly. Okay, so if you do the variation of this action that I showed you before with respect to the metric, you get some field equations, which some of you may recognize as the field equations of Brunswick theory. Variation with respect to this field chi gives you r minus chi times f second is equal to zero. So you get back the fact that if f second is different from zero, chi is equal to r. So when I've done that, I can recognize my action as a Brunswick theory action. And the field equations are those that you see in the books for Brunswick theory. So this will be the action in terms of the new field phi. So I just change the names now. And this is the action. So I get phi r, a scalar field that couples non-minimally to the Ricci curvature, exactly like in Brunswick theory. There is no kinetic term for the scalar field, which corresponds to this factor omega that weighs the gradient square of phi equal to zero. And then you get a potential, which is something complicated. And that's why people did not know very much about this subclass of scalar tensor theories, because the potential is complicated and is defined implicitly. I think I can skip this part here. So now you want to know if your theories of gravity are viable or not. Well, you got some minimal criteria for the viability of this f of r gravity. First of all, you want to explain the cosmology now, so better have the correct cosmological dynamics. Second, there shouldn't be instabilities, fatal instabilities for the theory, and this could happen. We don't want ghost fields because, well, those are deadly for particle physics in general and for theories of gravity. You want, of course, to have the correct Newtonian limit and post-Newtonian limit. You don't want to violate the experiments that are there. Thanks. And you must have some predictability, so the Cauchy problem must be well posed. And cosmological perturbations must be compatible with what we know from the cosmic microwave background and large scale structure. So let's start with the correct cosmological dynamics. That one works, so you want to have some early inflation or some substitute for that. There is no proof that inflation happened after all. You must have a radiation era, which is well constrained by Big Bang nucleosynthesis. You must have a matter era during which you form galaxies. Then you enter in the present accelerated epoch. And then it will end up with some future that we don't really know. Could be the sitter, could be a big rip, who knows. Depends on the form of the theory that you have. Not only that, you must have a smooth transitions between these eras. And at some point, there were some problems. People claimed that you get stuck into the radiation era with the f of r gravity, and you can't get out of that. That's not true, because there is you can find an equation for this function f of r. And if you prescribe the expansion history of the universe that you want, you can always solve that equation and find more than one function f of r that gives you the prescribed evolution. So you can get the cosmology that you want. Instabilities, well, I don't have the time to go through the argument. Basically, you can make a local stability analysis saying my space is locally like a space of constant curvature, because if I don't wait long enough, I don't see the universe expanding. And I can say that locally is like Minkowski space. Then I can do a stability analysis of that trace equation that I showed you before. So I take the trace of the field equation, and I get an equation for the time evolution of perturbations in the curvature. There is an effective mass square for that field. And you find that mass square is 1/3 pi second was actually the curvature f second. So you need to have a second non-negative to have stability. And this is a general result for all f of r theories. That's a local stability analysis. That means you're considering only modes that have wavelengths very, very, very small. You can do better if you consider the sitter space with constant curvature, which always happens in cosmology. So we get another condition. But This local condition is very, very strong. So if you violate that, your space-time explodes, goes away, the theory is completely unstable. So F prime positive and the second positive is what you want in general. I think I can skip the sitter space. Ghost, in general, I'm out of time already. Okay, so I'll try to wrap it up. So basic life of our gravity doesn't have ghosts. This would be states that violate unitarity, and those are a big worry. Weak field limit, the weak field limit can be satisfied only if your field has built in some chameleon mechanisms. We were talking about chameleons yesterday. So essentially, if you do the weak field analysis, and it has taken a few years, you find that these are always effective scalar field always violates the weak field limits grossly, unless you have a chameleon mechanism in that theory. This chameleon mechanism is not something that you put in by hand, but it's something that is built into the theory. It was discovered for quintessence models, scalar field models of dark energy. It's also present in many of these FFR theories. So that's essential for these theories to work. And it's not something that you put in by hand, but it's something that is built into the theory. I will just tell you something. So far I talked about the unperturbed universe. Pretty much any theory of gravity that you want to push will have the same Friedman-Robertson-Walker solution for the unperturbed universe. So the game in recent years are moved towards looking at perturbations of the Friedman-Robertson-Walker model. This is because when you form perturbations during inflation or in some other mechanism, you have these perturbations have to grow. The growth of these perturbations is sensitive to the theory of gravity. So what people are doing now is studying how these perturbations grow and comparing these with the studies of larger structure surveys, and correlations between larger structure surveys and the cosmic microwave background. You can't really tell much now, but there will be experiments coming up like Euclid and so on, other experiments that will actually be able to study these perturbations. So the game on modified gravity now has moved to study the perturbations. So I get to the conclusion. So FFR gravity, at the end of the day, is something like a Tor model, so I wouldn't take it too realistically. But these FFR theories are some relatively simple theories that tell you that you can modify gravity. And there are lots of models that pass all the experimental tests. For example, the new Starobinsky model here, some kind of complicated function. And all these models to pass the test require this chameleon mechanism. So testing for chameleons means that you're testing also for FFR gravity. And you need a F second of R larger than zero. The Palatini version of this theory has a lot of problems and is now dead. The metric affine version is still undeveloped, so there will be something to look at. And the future of FFR gravity is studying cosmological perturbations, essentially. So I'll wrap it up here. And thanks for listening.
So,
obviously a lot of the discussion has come about scalar fields and vector fields and things like this that we might be searching for. And, you know, there's a lot of connections between different experiments sort of based on kind of a particle physics perspective on that. But then, of course, usually you think the GR and particle physics don't quite fit together. So I guess my question is, early in the talk, you talked about, these kind of FR theories can give rise to scalar vector tensor components of gravity. Are those subject to the same kind of constraints from experiments, kind of laboratory searches that, particle physics searches? I guess, does quantum field theory apply to these things?
Yes. What I was showing is the field. What is the field content of the theory? So this would be the language of a particle physicist. What is the field content of the theory? Turns out that these experiments, local experiments, probably have little hope to seeing these things, except for gravitational waves. Gravitational waves would be somehow different because you get scalar waves that propagate in addition to the usual tensor waves. So we can talk about that, and there are experiments looking for chameleons, so they will be looking also for these fields here. But in principle, it's just like any field theory, you get some field content, and you should be able to look for this field.